Hey there. You're listening to WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is your community radio station, 103.5 on the FM dial. You can reach us web streaming through communityradio.coop. That's .coop. I'm your host, and you're listening to another edition of Touchstones. And today we are going to wrap up, whether we complete or not, we're going to wrap up a ongoing discussion of the mystic writer Richard of St. Victor. For those of you who weren't tuned in to the earlier shows where we discussed Richard of St. Victor, and specifically his Benjamin Minor, we're going to be discussing today his secondary work, which is the Benjamin Major, which specifically deals with the kind of internal discrimination that one needs to develop as one proceeds along the inner contemplative path. On that note is a friend of mine, a poet from New York, Cynthia Tedesco, sent me some poetry a few days ago. And every time I read good poetry, I become envious of poets and attempt to write my own. In my case, within looking at Cynthia's poems, I enjoyed digging up a few poems that I had written some years back, of which I'm going to share one. And I think I will both open and close the show with this short poem, which is actually the prologue to a series of poems which were called The Seven Levels of Silence, that actually have never been written, which probably is a fitting tribute to The Seven Levels of Silence. What can you say about the unsayable? You say, I am you, and I know I am not you. I am I. How can both be true? There is not two, which only seems to when there is no I to know or say no. I guess this no is the big yes. You mean when I heard myself erased in the bliss of your incandescent face that shines vacant and fully open? Upon everything that happens to be around, a wholly beautiful sound that lets objects sing up their souls into luminous hollows that seem so hard on top and yet are so empty inside, except for your silence, a mighty long resonant silence that secretly says, I am you, and you are everything just as it is, as it is, it is. So today we move back to a consideration of Richard of St. Victor, and I am going to begin this section by reading a little about the Benjamin Major, starting with the which is also known as the Mystical Arc. The text that we're reading from is Richard of St. Victor, The Twelve Patriarchs, The Mystical Art, and Book 3 of the Trinity, translated with an introduction by Grover Zinn and a preface by Jean Chatillon. And it was one of the early volumes or offerings in the classics of Western spirituality. So, to begin again with the what the nature of contemplation, which is what the mystical art is about. By contemplation, Richard means an attitude of mind, a state of beholding. In the mystical art, he gives a classic definition. Contemplation is free, more penetrating gaze of the mind, suspended with wonder, concerning manifestations of wisdom. The use of the word contemplatio, although it has much that is special to Richard in its meaning, continues to retain much of the basic meaning of the word, which is an attentive or eager looking at. Above all, it must be clearly understood that contemplation is not some sort of mental process. Richard, like you of St. Victor before him, is careful to distinguish thinking, or rather rambling, consideration of many things without purpose, and meditating, intent mental activity concentrated upon one thing or purpose for the gaining of knowledge, and from the act of contemplating. The same object may at various times be the object of thinking, meditating, or contemplating. The contemplative act itself is an intent beholding, focused upon a single object or clustable objects presented to the mind by imagination, reason, or pure understanding that alone has access to divine things. As Richard says clearly, contemplation always deals with things, either manifested according to their nature, known intimately by study, or made clear by divine showing. The purpose of contemplation is not thinking about something, rational, understanding, ferreting out new truths, or any like mental operation. It is rather an adhering with wonder to the object that brings it joy. It is a non-discursive and unified. It enjoys rather than uses. It rests rather than acts. One can say in some ways that thinking, meditating, and contemplation form a successive arc in mental attention and attentiveness. Thinking is just the chitter-chatter, internalized conversation and thinking of, and thought and social chatter of our own exterior lives, and seems to ramble and roam on its own basis and flips, you know, it's like many tracks flipping from one to another without necessarily knowing what necessarily are the switches that cause repetitions or cause changes in the direction of one's thinking. Thinking is a kind of noise that takes place in our mind, not unlike the noise that we understand in our dreams that seem to make no sense. But thinking is probably more verbal for most of us, and to other sense it could also be a visual and or an emotional ride, a semi-daydream that floats along. And, you know, this is obviously not the thinking of the philosophers, but this is thinking, and this is kind of what most of us do distractedly throughout the day, paying attention to it or not, as the case may be. Meditation, and this is a use of meditation that's more relevant to not necessarily the meditation as talked about by the Buddhists, but it is a kind of meditation which is paying attention to what your mind's doing, which is in itself not easy to do, paying attention to it. And then the next thing you would go with meditating is that you concentrate. And concentrate is bringing things to a focus by paying attention to what you're thinking about, by really listening to it, by observing it and noting it and noticing its motions and noticing the little ways that it distracts itself and changes its direction and the repetitions that go on there. We can learn a great deal of ourselves just by paying attention to ourselves. Of course, it helps to like ourselves to do that. And sometimes we would rather, where there is an innocent aversion that doesn't like ourselves, so it's a lot easier not to pay attention to what we're thinking and feeling because it isn't pleasant. I'm sorry to say that may be more common experience than some of us would like to admit. So, concentrating, meditating then is focusing and bringing down into one flow, a undistracted, unswitchable kind of flow of thought upon one single object, one motion or focus of intent. And it helps that this be something that is either sensorially present, the classic watching the candle flame, or mentally present, visualizing the candle flame and seeing it solidly inside and visualizing it clearly, realizing it's there and paying attention to it and all of its things, and noticing how you want to move away, you want to switch, you want the wild horse wants to go where it wants to roam, and you want it to stay firmly under control. This is no easy thing to do. The nature of the mind, the nature of our thinking processes, in that most of our lives is spent in a semi-wild and unconscious state, wants to stay semi-wild and unconscious reactive state. It doesn't want to focus here. But to the degree that we gather up our meditative faculties and enter into this meditative situation, we bring to things a focus and an attention that is powerful and simple and edifying. And one of the things that happens is that our ability to be creative and attentive and to do what we set out to do becomes more possible than it is otherwise. And this brings us to this focused and intentive aspect of meditation, that when it works to where it starts to become habituated, in other words, the same craziness and wildness that affects people in one way now becomes open and easy to appreciate, because the and of course, it becomes sort of automatic. In other words, the same habitualness that has been the wildness of our mind becomes habituated to become alive to the discipline that we have put it under through the meditating and through the paying attention. And contemplation then is an extension of that. Of that discipline, showing up in a adhering with wonder to the objects that bring joy. And the thing is that objects that bring joy are not necessarily exterior objects, but rather interior objects by which we understand these things. So, I stepped away from the text and also from the exact meaning of Richard of St. Victor, and we're now continue. Again, Richard of St. Victor lived around 1100 and was part of the beginning of the high scholastic spiritual discipline. In book one of the mystical arc contains the famous Ricardian distinction of the 6 degrees of, or kinds of contemplation. This distinction does not introduce six different varieties of contemplation, but rather offers a sixfold division of the objects that may be contemplated. The 6 degrees represents an ascension in being from the sensual world perceived by the bodily senses and known to the mind, through the imagination, through the interior world of reason, to the transcendent world of spiritual realities, divine nature, and trinity. Anything whatsoever may be the object of contemplation, from the simplest acorn to the ineffable manifestation of the Trinity in ecstatic contemplation. Furthermore, contemplation is not the operation of the understanding in human beings, which faculty alone has access to divine realities, as opposed to reason and imagination. Understanding, reason, and imagination all provide objects fit for contemplation. The analysis of the 6 degrees or kinds of contemplation is a presentation of the specific ways in which the objects of each level of ascension are perceived by the mind. The mode of contemplation, which may be suited to a specific kind of object, is a matter to which we shall return later. Suffice it to say here that ecstasy is but one of the 3 modes of contemplation. According to Richard, the 6 kinds of contemplation are divided thus. 1. In imagination and according to imagination only. 2. In imagination and according to reason. 3. In reason and according to imagination. 4. In reason and according to reason. 5. Above reason but not beyond reason. And 6. Above reason and seemingly beyond reason. Think of them as little babushka dolls, each one nestled inside the other, in which, as it were, the greatest or the least of the babushka dolls is the above reason and seemingly beyond reason, as opposed to, and underneath that is above reason but not beyond reason. And around that is wrapped in reason and according to reason. And around that is in reason according to imagination. And around that is wrapped in imagination and according to reason. And in the exterior is imagination according to the imagination only. In this pattern, 2 kinds are in imagination, 2 are in reason, and 2, as indicated, are in understanding. Or in this case, understanding being beyond reason. In the succeeding chapters of Book 1, Richard weaves a rich tapestry of the interrelations and distinctions connected with these 6 distinct levels of knowing. Books 2-4 offer a very detailed exposition of the kinds of objects that are accessible to each of these 6 levels of knowing and contemplating. Throughout the Mystical Arc treatise, Richard refers to the objects of contemplation at all levels by the word speculum. We have translated it as manifestation in the definition of contemplation offered above and to all their places in the treatise, but we also have to insist that the various specula are perceived by the individual through the imagination, through the reason, and through understanding. Understanding here is intelligentia, and intelligentia here represents the apprehensive aspect of consciousness. Understanding here is then not an intellectual understanding of reason, aha. It's rather the understanding of direct perception or direct consciousness or awareness of something in an appropriate combination of imagination and reason, and reason and understanding. The issue here is that understanding here is being used in the sense of submission, in the way that submission is Islam, a submission to the divine, which is taking one's own awareness and surrendering it to the source of the great awareness, which is the divine presence. In offering his detailed analysis of the objects of contemplation at various levels, Richard constructs a complex epistemological structure dividing and subdividing the many classes of objects suitable for contemplation. In his analysis of books 2 and 4, it is significant to note that it refers most frequently to various kinds of speculations rather than kinds of contemplation. The reason for this would seem to be that in his analysis, Richard is concerned with classifying manifestations of divine wisdom and the ways of knowing them. Knowing is speculial at first, That is, concerned with the outer world of material existence, the inner mental world of spiritual reality as mirrors that manifest the power, wisdom, and goodness of the triune God, or the manifestations of divine truths in a showing. As Richard points out elsewhere, speculative people are those who still see by a mirror and in an enigma. The contemplatives behold directly without any shadow or veil. Perhaps we are meant to understand that in the act of perceiving something through the imagination is, or reason, there is a veil or a mirror as opposed to the experience of contemplating, which is a direct seeing. The latter is without activity. Contemplation is without activity. It is a resting, loving, wondering apprehension of the manifestation of the divine. Now, intelligentio as a resting, loving, wondering apprehension of the manifestation of the divine is your one's direct awareness. I am breaking out of the text, which I kind of wished I had done, were able to do sooner than this third and last program of about Richard of St. Victor. The first kind of contemplation is concerned with physical things as things. To contemplate is simply to behold the world or the part of it with the kind of loving wonder we have described above. It requires just as much discipline of the mind and inward quiet as any other contemplation, only its object is lowly and is perceived by the lowest faculty of the mind, the imagination. The objects of this contemplation are divided and subdivided. The first division separates things, works, and worlds. Things are divided into matter, form, and nature, or substance. The first two are knowable, and the last remains always partially unknown. Works are divided into the works of nature and the works of human activity. Again, the latter are fully understandable. The former remain in part inaccessible to human comprehension. Morals are divided into human instruction and divine instruction. And the second kind of contemplation is concerned with the rational principles of physical things. In other words, reason now enters into the picture and provides analytical and abstract knowledge of visible things. According to the categories listed in the first speculation, the object of this contemplation is then one step removed from the world as immediately experienced, and this a reason it is described as in imagination, but according to reason. In discussing the first two kinds of contemplation, Richard is very much concerned to contrast the work of Christian thinkers with the false idea of the philosophers who have built their arcs of wisdom. By having inferior, insufficient materials, the latter have failed in their attempts, according to Richard. The third contemplation is said to be in reason, according to imagination. This level involves knowledge of invisible spiritual realities, but that knowledge is gained by means of similitudes drawn from the physical world. The imagination leads by reason, by hand, as it were, because the knowledge is gained by reason, but through the use of visible things known through the imagination. This is the famous Victorine idea of the manuductio, or the guiding hand, that the world provides in the quest for spiritual truth. The roots lie in the ideas of Dionysius about the world as a symbolic manifestation of divine reality, and the return to knowledge of God via symbols that are both revealed and high truth. Richard was clearly the heir of Hugo of St. Victor in this perception of the ascent to spiritual realities by means of visible realities according to the similitude. Richard puts it succinctly, and this is a quote, but since the investigation of this speculation cannot be led to the knowledge of invisible things without the assistance of corporeal similitudes, reason seems to be following the leading hand of imagination in this part and has shown clearly to hold on to it, the leader of the journey, as it were, in the course of its search. For while imagination presents forms of visible things to reason and instructs itself from the similitudes of the same things for the investigation of invisible things, in a certain manner it brings reason to that place in which it did not know how to go by means of itself. For reason would never rise up to the contemplation of invisible things unless the imagination, by means of representing the form of visible things, were to show from what it would draw a similitude in those things and forms the mode of its investigation. Elsewhere, Richard refers to the material objects as providing a staff of corporeal similitude. This supports the third contemplation, which lifts itself on to high things by means of a ladder, so to speak, of the particular nature of corporeal things. The ladder has a long history as the symbol of a spiritual ascent, but one thinks here especially of Richard's influence on St. Bonaventure and the latter's use of the ladder theme as a symbol of ascension in his Itinerarium Mentis Deduum. The mystical arc offers a fivefold division in this way of knowing invisible spiritual things based on the fivefold consideration of things used in the second kind of contemplation. These are the particular matter of a thing, the external quality of something, that's its form, the internal quality of a thing, its nature, what is done in or by a thing by necessity, and what is done according to the purpose or will and by artificial motion. Richard then shows how a deeper meaning can be found in various scriptural verses using the five categories above as a way for determining a spiritual meaning. This not only reveals Richard's skill as an interpreter, but also reminds us that Victorine exegesis systematically insisted that the spiritual senses of Scripture be found upon the meaning of things in Scripture and could not be merely wordplay. There is a metaphysical and theological, even soteriological, rationale for the pursuit of deeper senses in Scripture, and in a more limited way in the Book of Nature, both as specula, the manifestations of God wisdom, and offering as a way towards understanding invisible spiritual things. To conclude Book 2 of the Ark, Richard offers a complex consideration of the relation of divine wisdom to the salvation and damnation of humanity, dividing this wisdom into God's knowledge, foreknowledge, disposition, and predestination. This is carried out as a detailed symbolic interpretation of the meaning of the rings set in the corners of the ark and the two poles that are inserted through the pairs of rings in order to carry the ark. Here, Richard is able to offer a rather subtle presentation of the questions of God's permission, which allows evil to exist in contrast to his working, his operation, which is only for good. The consideration seems a bit out of place at this point in the Ark's treatise, but it is necessary to put it where it is, says Richard, because the rings in the pole appear at this point in the biblical narrative, and the order of reason requires that some things be said briefly and in this place concerning the rings and the poles, so that the same order may be followed in exposition as the author wished to follow in the description of the ark. Following the third kind, which involves an incipient interiorization, Richard moves to the fourth, which is marked by a complete interiorization. It is in reason according to reason. Richard devotes the entire third book to this contemplation, indicating both the importance it held for him and the extent to which this analysis and its divisions, this fourth speculation, contemplation concerning knowledge of rational spirit only, either the soul of man or of angels, and the distinction between this kind of contemplation and the earlier three is strongly stressed. Here the imagination that is in the reason's relationship of the world is completely excluded from any participation. In the imagery of building the ark, this world is a pure gold having no wood. Ideas from the material world derived via imagination or contact with wood. In the fourth kind, the focus of consciousness turns completely within the soul, rejecting all imaginative consciousness. The mind is aware of itself only as it explores the secret and deep things of the self. Also at this time, the pure understanding, intelligentsia, may begin to function, thus providing some direct knowledge of things that are above and not only human sense, but human reason also, namely angelic spirits and the deep things of God. This is very different from the kind of knowledge by similitude of the third level of knowing. However, the first entrance into all such matters is by way of complete and thorough knowledge of oneself. Richard introduces images drawn from several scriptural passages to elucidate this quest for knowledge of the soul and other rational spirits. From Ecclesiastes 1:5, he comes this. The sun rises and sets, and it returns to its place where rising again. This is taken to commend a mental interiorization while also offering an opportunity to explore the ascension, the rising sun, that is associated with interiorization. The parable liking the kingdom of God to a treasure buried in the field, as in Matthew 13:44, is interpreted as to mean the riches of divine wisdom hidden in the depth of the human heart, especially the imago Dei. The search for God's kingdom and his wisdom that must be a quest within to the depths of the human heart and beyond. The Pauline reference to a third heaven brings Richard to a distinction of three heavens. The first, the imaginative, the second, the rational, the third, the intellectual. This corresponds to the tripiate division of mental faculties Richard uses, but more importantly, it puts them into an ascending pattern that stresses the world to which each has access. The imaginative heaven of this world, the rational heaven, is the marvelous and remarkable world of the inner self, ruled over by the sun of the soul. The intellectual heaven is the awesome world of the transcendent realities that circle about the true and eternal sun of God. There is also an eye for each heaven, the fleshy eye, which sees the material world, the eye of reason, with which we seek and find hidden and absent things by means of investigation, or as we often understand, causes by effects and effects by causes. The eye of the understanding by which we see invisible things ourselves and of God. As Richard said so forcefully, this intellectual eye grasps invisible things invisibly, to be sure, but presently and essentially, so that one sees with it in a way analogous to corporeal sight. However, in the present human condition, this intellectual eye is veiled, so that it sees nothing of the divine things unless God should will to unveil this eye. This notion of the three eyes and the veiling of the third eye was formulated by Hugh of St. Victor. Richard employs it with great effect to point out to the soul's three ways of seeing the spiritual blindness of the present human condition, apart from God's action of grace and restoration. The object of this fourth speculation, contemplation, are divided by a triple distinction of the divine gifts in spiritual essences. First is existence given in creation. The second is goodness conferred through being made just. And the third is blessedness from being glorified. Like almost all of Richard's patterns, this one is concerned with progression, both cosmic from creationism to consummation, and personal through various stages of spiritual growth outlined in the 12 patriarchs in the mystical arc. Here, Richard focuses especially on the soul as it advances in spiritual maturity and comes to full perfection. The goods of creation are divided into existence, knowing, and willing, with special emphasis on the freedom of the human will. Goodness that comes through being made just is subdivided into that which comes to the gift of the Creator through aspiration and that which comes through our own action via the deliberation of the will. Consideration of the will in the first distinction concerns the existence of free will and its greatness in the second, the exertion of the will, its efforts and merits. Blessed of conservation remains always unknown, says Richard, except for the brief and fleeting experiences of spiritual joy one has in this life. These first fruits of future happiness form the substance and the object of speculation, contemplation of the third distinction. As to clarify things, Richard ends a book three with a review of the five subdivisions of this kind. There is much to ponder in this conclusion, for it is a multifaceted presentation of Richard's understanding of the human soul, the apex of creation. He considers the essential nature of the soul as subsisting eternally, the marvelous intellectual capacity of the soul, the various states of the affections, changing almost instantly from love to hate or exultation to lamentation, the formation of the virtues in the soul, recording the 12 patriarchs on the order and moderation, the gifts of the spirit that work blessedness in this life and the next. The concluding chapter on the gifts of the spirit is a marvelous outpouring of praise as Richard considers the harmony of these gifts that inspire the soul in the angelic host. The work of the spirit of the soul is likened to the work of a skillful harper who turns his instrument carefully, stretching and loosening strings, plucking them sharply until a certain melody, mellifluous and sweet beyond a measure, resounds from them. So the harmonious soul, with its ordered and moderated virtues inspired by the Spirit, will resound into the ears of the Lord Sabaoth, as it was from the playing of the many harpers upon harps. At this point, Richard's vision shifts immediately from the harmony of one soul to the great concord that must result from the harmony of many souls of each other. The constant concord and concordant consonance of so many angels and holy souls exulting and praising God who lives a world without end. The great Victorine theme of the concord of many souls in the community in a shared knowing and loving is sounded with great weight and effect. The book, which begins with a consideration of the created soul and its individual nature, concludes with a moving vision of the eternal felicity, not of one soul, but of many thousands united in joy and praise. Again, as in so many passages of Richard's works, the themes of community and the place of the individual within that unity are woven into a fabric of thought. His vision of is not that with from the flight of the alone to the alone, but the flight of the one who is recovering a sense of love and community to that ineffable unity, which is a true trinity in the midst of community. The last and highest two kinds of contemplation are the subject of the fourth book of the mystical arc. The objects of these contemplations cannot be discovered by human reason. They are given by God through the faculty Richard calls understanding. In the fifth kind, these are things that are above supra-reason power. They are known but are not beyond the ability of reason to comprehend. These are especially things having to do with the divine substance and its unity. The sixth kind are those which are not only above the power of reason discover, but they are beyond comprehension by the reason and even seem to be contrary to all reason. Such things are what one believes about the Trinity or the three persons in one God. As we shall see later, the radical separation between the first four kinds and these last two is indicated by the fact that the first four are symbolized by the building of the Ark of the Covenant, and the last two are symbolized by fashioning images of the two seraphim, purely spiritual beings out of pure beaten gold. One seraphim represents the fifth kind and the other the sixth. In considering the objects of these last two contemplations, Richard makes much of the distinction between the mutuality of the seraphim. The seraph on the right is the fifth kind, above but not beyond reason, on the side of similitude of knowledge and the unity of the divine, and the seraphim on the left of the sixth kind, beyond, even contrary to reason, the side of dissimilitude and the knowledge of the Trinity of persons in one divine nature. The truth represented by each seraphim is united with the truth of the other in mutual concord, not divisive conflict. With one, what one affirms concerning the unity of God, the other must not destroy by the affirmation of the Trinity and vice versa. A rather complex consideration of the unity and Trinity of God is indicated in this. Here, Richard insists that knowledge of God's unity and Trinity is above the capacity of reason to discover without divine assistance. Though either a divine showing or ecstatic contemplation, this knowing comes through the understanding as distinct from the reason or imagination. However, once God's unity is affirmed, reason can comprehend it and offer some arguments concerning it. With the Trinity, however, and not only there, and absence of any proof from experience or an a priori demonstration by reasoning, these are absent in the previous case also. It is also the case that once known, the Trinity is not something that can be reasonable. It can be believed. It cannot be proved except from the authorities and miracles and divine showings. As the discussion of these two kinds of contemplation proceed, it is clear that Richard understands them as experienced primarily in the contemplative mode of ecstasy, excessus mentis. Indeed, Richard points out very clearly that the first four kinds of contemplation are ordinarily experienced in non-ecstatic ways, not the last two are ecstatic. However, there are some things to the first four kinds that nevertheless may be known in ecstasy or in a divine showing, and on occasion things known in the last two kinds can be the subject of non-ecstatic contemplation. Among the several personifications used in Book 4, Moses and Beelzebul apply here. Moses ascended a mountain and entered the cloud in order to see the ark and seraphim. Hence he saw in ecstasy six kinds of contemplation. Beelzebul, who constructed the ark and fashioned the cherubim, neither climbed a mountain nor entered into the cloud, in the symbolic effect that occasionally even the deepest secrets known in ecstasy may be subject to contemplation in a non-ecstatic mode. Beelzebul also represents the functions of teaching about the six kinds of contemplation to persons on the contemplative path. And in Book 5, Richard represents the laser of Beelzebul as building the ark and the seraphim of his own labor in the treatise. Richard recognizes the ambiguity of the unknowing of ecstatic contemplation. He fully incorporates the Dionysian theme of the state of unknowing that characterizes ecstasy. Ecstasy takes one beyond rational consciousness, beyond a veil into darkness. However, the Victorine canon can also take account of the fact that for some there is a memory that gives limited and veiled access to the experience. And I'm quoting here, "And although we may retain a memory of something that the experience and see it through a veil, as it were, as though in the middle of a cloud, we lack the ability to comprehend or call it to mind either the manner of seeing or the quality of the vision. And marvelously, in a way, remembered, we do not remember, and not remembering, we remember. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the Pharaoh exemplify, respectively, those who recall nothing from ecstasy and those who remember to some degree and reflect upon what they have seen in ecstasy. In another set of biblical images, when Abraham brings the Lord into his tent with Mamre and represents such marvelous remembering, failure to bring the Lord back on the second occasion represents the not remembering aspect. Richard's argument on this topic is rich and complex and must be read carefully and we fully with full attention to the symbolism to be appreciated. He clearly wants to give full scope to a variety of contemplative experiences and the objects of each within the range of human experience. Up to this point, we have been discussing the six kinds of speculation contemplation, primarily from the aspect characterized by each, the faculties of mind involved in such things. We now return to the beginning, as it were, and consider the symbols by means of which this teaching is set forth and meant to be grasped. The symbolic forms are about to discuss the most certainly not an addendum for Richard. They are actually the basic foundation, the teaching and its elaboration. Richard's way of proceeding is from the symbol to the truth. The symbol is not an abstraction or a representation of ideas. It is rather a concrete manifestation of truth. Two separate symbolic forms are involved. The Ark of the Covenant and the pair of seraphim accompanying the Ark in the inmost chamber of the Tabernacle of the Covenant. This tabernacle with its furnishings was revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai. For Richard, it represents a symbolic manifestation of the spiritual journey. Certainly the tabernacle has been interpreted symbolically before, but the interpretations have been allegorical, focused on Christ and his church. Richard's new contribution is to say something of on the tropological sense, thus building a clue in the writings of Augustine and Gregory the Great. The narrative of the construction of the ark is followed carefully and with a division into four significant stages. One, the making of the frame of the pieces of the setim wood. Two, the gilding of the wooden ark. Three, the making of a crown of pure gold. The crown encircles the ark and is attached to the wood of the ark and goes above the top of the ark. Four, the making of a preparatory or mercy seat out of pure gold, and this provides a cover for the ark. The seraphim are made of pure gold, beaten and shaped into the image of the six-winged creatures that are the apex of the angelic hierarchy and are thus nearest to God. The materials and the dimensions of each part of the ark are important. Wood represents knowledge derived from the senses and is the imaginative faculty. Gold refers to reason, while the purest gold, which is propitiatory, and the seraphim are fashioned and refers to an understanding, intelligentsia. Each of the four stages in the building of the ark refers to one of the first four kinds of contemplation. The arc of wood represents contemplation, that is, an imagination according to imagination. The gilding of the arc represents the second contemplation, since it is the overlaid of gold, indicates the function of reason is seeking out rational principles and thing. The third kind of contemplation is properly signified by the crown, which is made of pure gold, but is attached at places to the wood of the arc. Pure gold indicates the dominant role played by reason. Attachment to wood means the imagination still plays a part in this contemplation, in which invisible things are known by means of visible things and their similitudes. The fact that the crown rises above the gilded wooden arc indicates that this contemplation of knowledge goes beyond the world perceived by the senses. The fourth kind of contemplation is represented by the cover of the arc, propitiatory, that is, a made of pure gold, and in no place touches wood, for it rests on either pure gold or gilding. And this level consists, as we have seen, of the complete interiorization of consciousness as the mind begins to function in reason according to reason, with the occasional or operation of understanding making known things beyond the power of reason. In addition to the significance of the material, Richard finds the dimensions of the various elements of the arc to be signified. A clever argument proves that in existence a fine logicality precedes a plane surface, and the plane surface is solid, and hence in consideration the arc dimensions must be taken in order to at length, width, and height. Having established what the length, width, and height of the arc or crown and the provisory symbolize, Richard then finds further subdivisions in these first distinctions in the dimensions as given in cubits. Furthermore, it will be seen that the full cubit indicates fullness of knowledge of a particular thing signified, such as human activity in the form of things, the half cubit meaning partial knowledge, such as the working of nature and inner substance. As noted earlier, the last two kinds of contemplation are symbolized by the seraphim. These kinds are more to do with divine things than human ability. Hence, they are symbolized in an angelic form. Richard emphasizes the difficulty in making these from beaten gold. Much labor must be expended both in purifying and in shaping the material, so the contemplative must exert himself or herself in such a way as to purify and shape life. As the reader will note, Richard makes much of the fact that the seraphim are winged creatures, hence ability to fly upward in ecstatic contemplation, and they are associated with the arc in a mutual sharing. In addition to the six kinds of contemplation we have been discussing, Richard also makes a very important distinction between three different modes in which the qualities of contemplation may vary. These modes are enlarging the mind, raising up the mind, and alienation of the mind, or ecstasy. Richard offers biblical types of these modes, enlarging and related the building of the ark, raising up of the ark, lifted up and carried beyond the cloud of divine presence, ecstasy, to placing of the ark beyond the veil of the Holy of the Holies. In another series of biblical persons, enlarging in the figure of Abraham, it is told to look up and gaze round about, raising up by Moses, who ascends Mount Nebo by his own effort, and then shown the promised land by divine grace, ecstasy by Moses' ascent and interest into the cloud on Sinai, and also the transfiguration. The primary distinction between the three modes is made with respect to the relationship of human effort and grace, and can be seen in the biblical figures just mentioned. Enlarging of the mind is the result of human effort alone. It is an art that can be learned from a good master or by reading, developed by continued exercise and brought to fruition and attention. which develops one's powers of beholding even more. This mode is likened to the watchtower in a series of biblical passages interpreted tropologically with respect to the 3 degrees of art, skill, and attention. It cannot be stressed too much that Richard does not mean that this first mode of contemplation is something like meditation or that it is an extension of ordinary mental activities. It is an acquired skill, just like other arts, but it is unique in that the art of contemplation and partakes of the qualities of rest and peace, comprehensive vision, and the like, which have been noted earlier. The second mode of contemplation, rising up of the mind, comes from joining human effort to the divine grace of the showing. Thus, the visions of light have an explicit and necessary connection with this mode of contemplation. In its something unknown is always made manifest to the mind through what Richard calls the raising up of the mind, and there are 3 degrees of being raised up. The last is the third mode of contemplation, ecstasy or alienation. Richard discusses 3 causes at length. They are the greatness of devotion, the greatness of wonder, and the greatness of exaltation. The concludes my introduction to the Ark of the Covenant, and that includes my introduction to Richard of St. Victor, who is one of the great theoreticians of contemplation in Christendom, particularly setting forth the developments that would come in the generations after him that gave us a Bonaventure, St. Francis of Assisi, and definitely Thomas Aquinas and Albert the Great. I thank you for tuning in. This has been a special edition of Touchstones in which we are dealing with the mystics. We've so far dealt with Meister Eckhart and Richard of St. Victor. We are going to change tones a little bit and be discussing certain great mystical works from Hinduism, and then we will be going back to our regular interview format. So again, thank you. This is Touchstones, and you are listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. It's you're on 103.5. It's your community radio station. And so long.